This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon. Paul's inspiring story, my own story, and Paul's presentation is a hard act to follow, I must say. We're starting at the very micro level in terms of the project that we're talking about here. Alan O'Connor introduced aspects of this yesterday when he was talking about the historical setting of the APY lands in South Australia, the little point you can see in the map, and I think we've had a few presentations on Bidinjara, so people will be familiar with that. The project was basically initiated by the communities who wanted to, in following on from some issues with petrol sniffing in their communities, said that petrol sniffing is the end of a problem. The actual start of the problem is that we've lost our enterprise, our engagement in the economy to some extent, and we would like to foster that and foster our own homegrown enterprise, micro-enterprises. So the project was aimed at basically taking John's model on the hybrid economy and looking at that point right in the middle about the intersection, what actually goes on at that point of intersectionality. And it was starting from the base... Whoops. Oh, it's doing this funny thing. I'm sorry. It'll just take a little bit longer to get it up. That's okay. All right. To explore the interaction of social and cultural factors in that space of intersectionality in the hybrid economy, as John has talked about. We had an initial meeting. There'd been build-up meetings, but one particularly big meeting where there were about 60 Arnangu present. We were quite sort of amazed. It was very hard kind of trying to take the proceedings, as they were fairly lively in Bidinjara, talking about the range of things that people wanted. And they went back to those sort of memories of the mission days. They wanted to re-establish the market gardens that they'd had. They wanted to establish initiatives in cultural tourism. There was discussion about operating a second-hand store, and then all sorts of things from reactivating the date farm to paper making to possibilities of a coffee barista, because people thought there was a killing to be made by the number of bureaucrats and white fellas who were marching through their community who would, you know, pay a fortune for a cuppa. So in terms of Dennis's model, certainly these were entrepreneurial suggestions. We also had the supportive engagement later on in the project of Bungala CEDAP at Port Augusta, who were very enthusiastic in the Port Augusta level of getting involved in the project. It was participatory action research methodology. Alan, as I mentioned, has been the API for the project, and it was fundamentally walking and, you know, walking and learning and listening alongside particular representatives of the communities in the homelands who are party to the project. Bottom-up research. Using a quote from Yateman, no amount of quality assurance and performance monitoring can substitute for complex ground-level information which government policymakers don't have, and that was basically our intent as researchers behind it. And obviously you'll all be familiar with a lot of literature on participatory action research, particularly suited to and particularly preferred by Arnangu, who had their own terminology and codification of research which they see about listening, walking and learning together. So it was very much an Arnangu preferred mode of researching. We've had community council meetings, we've had partner feedback sessions, and certainly a great deal of adding a value by our Uniting Care Wesley partners, who are the modern day heirs to the mission. So it's the Uniting Church, their NGO agency, Uniting Care Wesley Adelaide. They became involved at the express wish of Arnangu, who said we would like them back involved in this project. But during that time, and also we've had the engagement of some private philanthropists, quite interesting, some retired academic geographer and anthropologist in Adelaide who wished to be involved in donating perhaps some social investment money to these enterprises over time, and also some add-ons from others that I'll mention on the way through. So it's been a really, I think, enthusiastic and positive and generative process from a research point of view. However, one of the things that has happened during the journey along this way has been the constant changes on the APY lands. There might be another line here. Yep. Oh, sorry. That's the been confused in my PowerPoint. There was COAG 1, which affected the lands as one of the 8 sites nationally. Now we have COAG 2, which is affecting Armitage and Mimili, though not directly our partners. Obviously, the communities are interconnected. We've had 3 waves of amendments to the API Land Rights Act and further to come. And during that time, what we've noticed also is that these changes drastically affected our partners. From a time when Markindy Minidjuku was the MSO when we started of Pukutja Community Council, there is now currently no MSO and no funded positions. It went from Markindy Minidjuku, who lost their job, about 3 Anangu lost their jobs in one sweep, who were fully employed, which we thought would be the aim of government policy at that time. And we had some non-Indigenous MSOs for a while. So there's been successive change during that time administratively. And, of course, then the regional Anangu organisations, one went into administration and a great deal of disputation between the APY executive and the AP services. All of these not directly involved in our project but affecting our partners and affecting the communities in really graphic ways, really profound sense of uncertainty and a sense of threat, changes to the CDEP program. We had the Mulligan report come through, which was our version of the Northern Territory investigation into child sexual abuse in the APY communities. And, of course, across the border, the kinship links remain, and the tri-state region is very active and alive with people moving through it, and the NTR in the territory really affected our community partners as well. While we were looking at social and cultural factors in terms of how that space was operating, what I wanted to share with you today, a number of aspects to the project, but what I wanted to share today is we began to look at social and cultural factors around non-Anangu and the disincentives that there were for our nascent entrepreneurs to get going. Some of the sorts of comments that were made are listed there. Now, these are not all of them, but they are representative. I've not ever encountered quite such a wall, and my colleague Bobby Banerjee can't be here today, also wanted to give his apologies. We were both absolutely shocked at the extent of negative feedback that there were from people that we interviewed about their interest or their vision of what could happen for Anangu in relation to enterprise. What's the use of training people if there's no work? Lack of employers, there's no work. No work opportunities. APY is a service industry and services don't make money. So developing Anangu small businesses is a waste of time. You can't have small business in a fiscal vacuum. Now, while at one level, you know, these are probably, non-exciting sort of realities, there was an extraordinary discourse of can't do, not able to, won't work, not possible. And so we've seen basically in the course of the project, and this is only one element, but I think it's an important one, both a structural arrangement of administrative affairs that works against incentive and enterprise by our community and homeland partners, that is actively, basically, if you like, constantly keeping people absorbed in a project about managing themselves and how to administer this 2,500 to 3,000 people and the instability that causes and so on. And at the same time, a production of a discursive environment which at the micro level affects relationships and affects people quite profoundly, that basically is one of non-belief that people would be able to do something. One particularly disturbing instance was when some young people who were involved in a clothing store, which I'll mention shortly, that people were establishing, they wanted to volunteer and get involved, and they actually got yelled at in a public place by some people in the community, non-Anangu people in the community, who felt that they didn't have the right to exercise that judgment to become involved and that they should have been doing something else at the time. And that was actually a really disturbing event. It shocked our UCW partners, who wrote some formal letters of complaint. And the people involved in that instance, I can say, are really decent people. They are not racist. And yet, at the micro level, there's a playing out of a discursive construction of the other that has really been quite disturbing. So some of the comments are listed there. So in a sense, we... Sorry, I might have just jumped the wrong page here. Okay. So in a sense, we've seen this process of two realities emerging. The first series of quotes there from Anangu, who were interested in being involved, young CDEP workers, and you can see the sort of enthusiasm that they expressed. Of course, people are, you know, watching things on television and so on, and exciting kind of things that they wanted to be involved in, quite heartfelt and quite interest. Very little understanding of what business would entail, but a sense that we are aware there are no Anangu-run shops or anything here. Older people speaking about this in a very strategic way, as we see this as about maintaining our culture on our land, and we see ways in which we can work direct from our homeland straight to the global market, was one elder actually grabbed a whiteboard pen and drew across the intersecting circles that we had about state, market and customary, just said, we want to bypass the state and head straight out there to the market. And that was about maintaining culture and passing on to the future generations some hope and enthusiasm for living on the homelands and some viability. Nobody had any expectations, not the older folk that we're dealing with or anyone, that this would lead to, you know, multi-millions of dollars. Although I think if they heard the Mauma project, they might actually begin to see that from little things, big things can grow. But there was a real strong sense that we can do something and a strong memory of the mission days, of course. So what we felt we're seeing in terms of the state market and the customary is an imposing taking up of the space by the state. And the state's not monolithic, as John reminded us yesterday. It is a field, if you like, and it also includes other civil actors, including those who've been very active and enthusiastic participants. However, it certainly is an incursionary kind of move by the state, and it seems to be accelerating. We've had the coronial inquest into petrol sniffing, the Mulligan report, as I said, and so this seems to have given an underpinning for a form of economic governance, as we would see it, that is both structural and discursive, with neo-colonial control, I guess, seems to be the motif that is operating, so that even really good people that we interact with in the privacy of the confidentiality of our interviews and or occasionally letting rip in public seem to have somehow sensed out of the NTR, perhaps, that there is a licence to actually perceive the current context as one of control over over Anangu. That drew us to think about a theoretical framing for what we see as something quite exceptional that is occurring in the lands in the last few years, and that took us to Foucault's notion of governmentality, the conduct of conduct, and there's some relevant quotes from Foucault where he talks about it's not a matter of opposing things to people, but rather of showing what government has to do with is not territory, but rather a sort of complex comprised of people and things. The things with which, in this sense, government is to be concerned are, in fact, people, but people in their relations, their links, their imbrication with those other things which are wealth, resources and means of subsistence. And in a sense, our micro-enterprises are really about subsistence, and they're about maintenance of pride, maintenance of culture, maintenance of identity. Oops, okay. So governmentality as a theme that we picked up. So I'll just skip through some of this pretty quickly because most of you probably know your Foucault. Linked to that, of course, is the element of biopolitics. I mentioned the inquiries that have gone through that have been concerned about the health and well-being of Anangu. But, of course, biopolitical strategy includes notions of the control of the population for its own good. In a sense that we think links with governmentality. And I've just put in there the reference to John's paper in 2007 in response to the NTR, which I think was a very powerful piece of work and powerful book, talking about neo-paternalism and the perhaps an agenda to incorporate Aboriginal Australians into mainstream liberal or neoliberal markets, and we see that happening. So there's this notion of seeking the normal, what is the normal Australian, as Howard would talk about, and some references there from Foucault to racism. I just want to skip through so I can get to some of the positives as well. Meanwhile, back on the ground, the customary economy, although it has actually been disenabled by things like the taking away of funding for a law and culture group that supported cultural business, and also the demands on people's time to be involved in constant and endless meetings seems to have become more customary. There is evidence of an increase in hunting going on, and there is obviously a continuation that seems to be sitting, as I say, two realities, and in some instances a reactivation of elements of customary economy, hunting, women's business, various sorts of things of that kind. One of the projects I'll just speak about very quickly, just before finishing, is there's been some very interesting work going on with the homeland cultural tourism. My university, through its sustainability cluster, is now committed to regular small-scale visits to the homeland, and they're using those as a base for the development of student placements only on the express wish of Anangu for special projects, and that will start to take place next year. Now, this injects both external dollars direct into the pockets of the homeland participants, and our homeland partners are talking about having a bit of a federated structure. We're not sure if it will go that way yet, where they actually rotate around the homeland so they all get a piece of the action, if you like, in terms of being involved. There has been a recent re-emergence of the family group involved in the homeland, who are coming together and saying we want to back this and develop it as a viable enterprise. Very quickly, the SOAPS project is going very well. That's a sole trader, but again, it's about a kind of a commodification of bush medicine and other sorts of products, and PY Media looking at online marketing for that. The clothing store I wanted to touch on very quickly, because Diana mentioned the importance of clothes and colour and fabric yesterday, and it just rang bells for me that I hadn't realised the continuum that there was there in terms of this really underlying interest of the community in running their own clothing secondhand store. And it's now been operating, it's in its third trial, and Anangu are very keen to run that and operate it as a social enterprise. It has been making a small profit once all the costs of transport and other things are taken into account, which is being held as a sort of trust fund to be re-injected back into supporting the clothing store. When it opened, the first day it opened, and Alan was there, I actually wasn't there, but he said that people were actually waiting for this to open and all gathering outside, and we got into trouble from the school because apparently a number of the Anangu teachers there just, you know, down pens and came over to sort of have a look at the clothing. So it's a very, very interesting enterprise, and also I think it links back to some things Diana was saying about the desire lines for goods. The last one I'll just touch on, this is a burial ground for vehicles on the APY lands. It's a fascinating place where there are a lot of vehicles around. It reminded me of the story about after the camels had finished that, and that Nick was sharing us, finished their productivity, they were sort of let loose at a certain point. Well, these are where the cars have been let loose, I think, when they've outlived their productivity. And there's a big issue brewing about recycling, about waste management in the APY lands. And our homeland partners have wanted to start their own recycling business, and they're currently engaged in a trial with one area of the state that has been extremely proactive, and that is Zed Waste in South Australia. And the university has a big waste research centre, and they're looking at actually building this. Perhaps there's some echoes there in terms of Myuma. Very quickly, there's some of the issues that we see, but I wanted to talk about the positives that are going on at that micro level that I think are really quite inspiring, and some of the questions about bridging and bonding capital. There's certainly a lot of bonding social capital occurring, but not much bridging, other than I think we are being able to make a difference in stimulating some of that through this small project. Issues of the external environment. Certainly Anangu are very actively engaged in the economy in the sense of supporting what is a really major service industry at the moment, but at the moment they're not engaged in the jobs in that industry. So we see that issue of economic governance and governmentality as a really I guess it's a theoretical and an abstraction from what we're seeing, but an important issue to be named and tackled. And I better finish there. I had lots more to say, but I better stop. I'll just put up, while we're doing the questions, some comments from Markinti Munajuku, who's written a letter to Jenny Macklin about issues in our communities.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Going over time.
These constraints are really frustrating, aren't they?
Second.
Okay. I love the picture of the cars and the rocks. The cars are blending into the rocks.
Stunning.
Fantastic picture, yeah.
That's Alan took that one.
Thanks very much indeed, Deirdre. I just wanted to make a comment about the cars. The car dump is on a men's sacred site, but the notice is now gone. And I did actually write a paper which was published in a Berg book called The Life and Death of Cars in 2001, which is precisely all about this. And it's about that dead cars aren't necessarily useless. That
yes.
Dead cars are, and I'm sure that you've probably looked into that, but dead cars are endlessly recycled for parts.
Yes.
Those dead cars were storage for men's sacred items, I believe, in the past. There's all sorts of uses for them, even though they appear to be
not
scrap
productive.
And rubbish, yeah, in our terms. So I just wanted to add to that.
I really appreciate that comment very much. I mean, the recycling project that is men who want to be involved in that, they actually want to negotiate also who more or less is custodian of which parts of the sort of burial ground of the cars, partly for some of the reasons you're saying, although I wasn't aware of some of the depth of that until quite recently. So it'll be very good to read your paper. And I think there are a lot of issues in it, but I guess what's colliding is this push from the government that there will have to be some process of waste management. People's desire to be actually in charge of that process where it relates to these vehicles in some way that actually enables them rather than an external person just coming in and pulling the vehicles out, but also to reclaim a lot of the usable materials. Because as you say, I mean, one of the elders that we work with said, well, you know, to Z Waste, you can't just clean up those cars. You know, they are mechanic shops and they have a number of other levels of utility to us. But thank you for your comment, because I wasn't aware of that connection as strongly until quite recently. So I'll look into it.
Hi. Thanks, Deirdre. It's Sarah Holcomb. I talk about some of these issues in my paper this afternoon, so I won't go on about it too much. But I guess I'd just be really cautious about going to a meeting with lots of anango and asking them in a shopping list approach way what their aspirations are.
Sure.
And then obviously you sort of get what whitefellas want to hear, because whitefellas understand bakeries, market gardens, things like that. So there's obviously a really significant reality gap between what anango actually really do want to do and what whitefellas want to hear. So there's a lot of sort of material out there, particularly Kane and Stanley wrote this rather
yep.
sort of excellent piece about the fact of, you know, the sort of government excitement about, you know, what they know and love, and the sort of gap between what Anangu are going to sort of carry on with, and horticulture is sort of a classic example there.
I really appreciate that comment too, and I probably skipped through that very quickly. That meeting, I mean, it was just that there was a sense of people coming, sort of flooding in, because the topic was getting some of those things back under discussion. But what we did do was then do a series of interviews. We also have done a number of processes of looking at what stayed in terms of what people actively wanted to do. I mean, the clothing store is an example of an ongoing interest, even when that wasn't a priority issue that was getting worked on, that people were... I guess the process has led to people also following some things up themselves that they had wanted to do. So I appreciate what you're saying, and there was a lot more
so
care
too,
taken
yeah,
into
The art centre, I mean, the art centre that's been going for 60 years is a great example that you would look at
Absolutely.
Structurally why that is successful, why, you know, Aboriginal people have for many generations actually been working in that space and,
yep.
you know... So there are good examples there that you can actually use.
Yeah, and I probably should have mentioned them too. I was sort of taking a particular focus, but they've been quite involved in also mediating some of the payments for people in relation to cultural tourism and some of the other enterprise activities, and have been really supportive and really involved as well. So I probably should have said more about that.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.